Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Thursday, November 29th, 2018. Going to talk later with Football Perspective's Chase Stewart about the Jets and about the changing math when it comes to the NFL. If you are someone who is into analytics, who is into coaches making bad decisions, that is going to be a segment for you in terms of understanding how the game is changing with the modern NFL and the modern rules and modern scoring. But first, joining us to talk about the Seahawks in the first segment of the show, it is a regular contributor to this very podcast. It is ESPN's Brady Henderson. Brady, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I will say I almost called you Brady Anderson. Does that happen a lot, or did that happen a lot when you were younger?
It did. In fact, there was, I think in like the sixth grade, this was around the time that Brady Anderson hit like 50 home runs to lead the American League. I dressed up as Brady Anderson for Halloween, and I think I got like second place school prize or something. Yeah, with the sideburns and everything.
That's incredible. It's like such like a moment in time where like if you did it 2 years earlier or 2 years later, I don't think anybody would have a concept of like Brady Anderson. But because it was that 150 home run season, I think that's perfect.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the Seahawks, a team that I think, you know, before the year, a lot of people, I think me included to some extent, kind of wrote off as being in a rebuilding season, a team that's sort of, you know, was being dominated by the players who had left, or in the case of Earl Thomas, the players who wanted to leave. And here we are. I mean, they're 6-5. They're projected by Football Power Index to win 9.4 games. They have a 78.7% chance per FPI to return to the postseason. So from your perspective, Brady, as someone who covers the team closely, are you surprised with where the Seahawks are heading into the final five games of the year?
You know, Bill, I had them, you know, at around 8-8, and I think right before the season, I kind of changed my mind and said 9-7, figuring that, you know, things, you know, could break their way and they were going to run the ball. And, you know, you mentioned that the FPI projections, having them at 78% chance to make the playoffs right now. Now, not a lot of people would have thought that, hey, heading into the season, and especially after they dropped to 0-2 after that Monday night loss to the Bears. So, you know, it's I think a little surprising just at how well a lot of things have come together. You know, the running game has been there. You know, last week was the exception because Carolina really took that away. But this team has gotten back to the running game that it had for, you know, the Marshawn Lynch days. And they really kind of hard times for 2 years. But I think that's been as big a reason as any is why they're in the position they're in now. You know, they're certainly not a great team. You know, they are a very imperfect team, and you saw that Sunday in Carolina, you know, when their defense got carved up, 476 yards by Cam Newton and the Panthers, 220 yards in the ground. They didn't even get a single hit, so much as a sack on Cam Newton.
Wow.
And they found a way to win that game. So this is not a great team, but it's a good team, and it's a team that, you know, just with the way the schedule is breaking now, and with the way they've positioned themselves, I think it's a team that's probably going to be good enough to make the playoffs as a wild card.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a resilient football team, I think it's fair to say, given that they, you know, faced the adversity of a difficult offseason, so many guys retiring or moving on. Earl Thomas, of course, then getting injured, and that whole sort of, you know, situation sort of, you know, distracted from what was happening with the team, and they sort of have settled into a, you know, a positive role. And like you said, the schedule is such a big thing for them. Four of their final five games coming up at home. And you brought up the running game as sort of the thing. I think it surprises me the most about their performance. And that's going to be built around not only the running backs, but the offensive line. And that was a huge problem for the Seahawks for several years, led to a lot of the changes they made seemingly on offense, where they did get rid of Tom Cable. They got rid of Darrell Bevell. They brought in Brian Schottenheimer. They brought in Mike Solari to work on the offensive line. Does the play of how that line, or does how that line played over the season, does it reinforce sort of the Seahawks fans' frustrations about Tom Cable, or does it actually sort of say, hey, you know, not Tom Cable was not a great coach, but at least he was on to some good ideas about the right sort of players being on the offensive line for the Seahawks?
I think it's more of the former than the latter. I think a lot of people, you know, the fact that they're running the ball the way they are, and you know, they're not as bad in pass protection either as they have been.
Sure.
So, you know, I think it definitely reinforces the idea that, you know, a lot of people wondered why on earth did Pete Carroll stick with Tom Cable as long as he did. You know, it's not like it's an entirely new group. You know, they've got some new pieces there, J.R. Sweezy, and DJ Fluker at the guard spots. But it's really, you know, the other three starters are the same starters you had last season. Now, part of that, too, is that Dwayne Brown, right when he, you know, got acquired in a trade last year, he sprained his ankle, so he was playing hurt for the rest of the season. So it's not an entirely new group. It's not an entirely different group. It's a lot of the same pieces, and it's a new scheme. And I think that's a big part of it, too, is that it's a lot more power, whereas Cable was running a lot of outside-inside zone. So it's a different scheme. And the other part of that, you know, we want to, I think the tendency of a lot of people, myself included, is to pin the credit on the offensive line and say that's the biggest difference. I think another big difference is the fact that you've got a healthier backfield now. And, you know, for all of the offensive line issues they had over the years and for all the times that group and Cable rightfully got hammered, it did not help that they were constantly cycling through running backs after Marshawn Lynch. They went from Thomas Rawls.
For sure.
To Kristen Michael, if you remember him, CJ Procise, you know, a lot of different guys there, and none of those guys could stay healthy. And I think it shows that, you know, the running back matters. As much as we want to say that, you know, you could plug in any guy in there behind a competent offensive line and he should be able to crank out 1,000 yards, you know, the running back matters, and they're seeing that because they've had, for the most part, a healthy Chris Carson this year, which they did not have last year. Remember, he got off to that great start last year. That bad injury, I think, right at the end of September, and their running game was not the same after that. So it's a combination of the new scheme, I think just a better offensive line with a couple of upgrades, and the fact that you have a healthy backfield for the first time in a few years.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say I'm a little offended that you would believe I would forget about Kristen Michael. This was this podcast was a hive of Kristen Michael content, so I will always remember Kristen Michael.
Of course.
I don't think my jersey, unfortunately, survived a move or two. Yes. In terms of the offense, is there a player who you think, independent of the people around him, has improved the most between 2017 and 2018?
I think it's got to be David Moore, and not just because I wrote a story about him on ESPN.com this morning. it's got to be David Moore. This is a guy who came from a tiny school, East Central Oklahoma, so small that Pete Carroll couldn't even really remember the name at one point this season. 3,600 students. It's in a town of like 17,000 people. It's a Division II school. Didn't even have a pro day. So this guy came from a very, very small, you know, sort of obscure background. And a little story about him is they drafted him in the seventh round last year because they were so high on him. And he basically spent the first 3 months of the season on the practice squad. And there was a time in late November when they thought they were going to lose him because the Colts wanted to sign him. And they gave him a decision, say, hey, we'll bump you up to the active roster to get you to stay. And he stayed. Mm-hmm. He ended up being inactive for the next five games. He only made his season debut in week 17. So it just went to show how high on his potential they were, that they were going to save roster spot for him even when he wasn't really playing, wasn't contributing at all. And so he started to emerge, you know, right after the first month of the season, right around the time that Brandon Marshall started struggling. So he supplanted Brandon Marshall, and he has become one of their biggest big play threats right now. I know Tyler Lockett's probably their best big play threat, but David Moore is averaging almost 19 yards per catch, which is second in the NFL. Wow. He's got five touchdowns, including the one on 4th-and-3 from 35 yards out Sunday that tied that game late in Carolina. And so he has kind of come, I don't want to say out of nowhere, but he's come from, you know, a pretty small background to be a big-time player for the Seahawks. So he's probably the player that from last year to this year that has improved the most.
Yeah, absolutely. And then thinking of that receiving core, you mentioned Tyler Lockett is playing very well. Doug Baldwin has not been 100% for a chunk of the year. Has had injuries come off and on. He had a weird season in that, you know, he's had a couple of would-be touchdowns that Russell Wilson seems to not hit him on, whether he's overthrowing him, whether it's just not just hasn't been there, but he's been open for opportunities, but hasn't necessarily made them over the past few weeks. So with regards to Doug Baldwin, I mean, do you think he is 100% or close to 100%, or is he more injured than perhaps, you know, we were seeing publicly from week to week?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Pete Carroll said last week that he felt like Doug was finally feeling the best he's felt all year, and I think that was on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then later that day in practice, apparently, Baldwin sort of re-aggravated this groin injury that he's been dealing with, and he didn't practice for the rest of the week, and that ended up being that he was questionable going into that Carolina game. So, you know, it's kind of been one thing after another for Baldwin. If you go back to the summer, You know, right at the start of training camp, there was a patellar injury that he suffered in one knee. And then in the season opener, after missing a month of training camp, he suffers an MCL injury on his other knee, and then the groin thing. So it's just been one thing after another. So, even if you know, Carroll seemed to be encouraged earlier this week by how he's doing with the groin, saying that he feels pretty good coming off that Carolina game, you know, I don't think he's going to be anywhere close to 100% at all this season. In fact, you know, at one point earlier in the season, he said one of the knee injuries, he's going to have to deal with it throughout the year. So, he's, you know, even if he's well enough to play, and he's a guy who was known to battle through a lot of injuries. I think he had a streak of like 89 consecutive games played at one point before, you know, he had to sit out in week two because of that second knee injury. So he's a guy who's going to play through a lot, but I don't think by any means he's going to be, at least not right now, anywhere close to 100%.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of that running back situation, you mentioned that having those guys healthy has been important. They haven't always been healthy, but, you know, there's certainly more depth and more talent at that position with Chris Carson, with Mike Davis, with Rashad Penny. How do you think that running back situation breaks down over the final 5 weeks of the year? Is it going to be a hot hand? Is it going to be a constant rotation? What do you think the Seahawks want to do, and how do you think it's going to actually play out over the rest of the year?
Yeah, you know what, Bill? I think as long as he is healthy, at least for this season, I think that Chris Carson is going to be the number one guy. And, you know, he's not a number one guy in the sense that Marshawn Lynch was the number one guy, as in like an every down back who's maybe only going to come off the field a few times. Because I think that we've seen that he's not built for that. You know, there was the game earlier this season. I think it was in the first month of the season. He got like 32 carries or something. And he couldn't play the next week because he was banged up. And that's kind of been his MO. He's had a hard time dating, you know, all the way back to college, really staying on the field. So I think that they feel like he gives them the best chance to be that, to give them that physical presence. You've seen him, you know, run over guys. He's up there among the league leaders in average yards after first contact. So he is the type of runner that Pete Carey really likes, Pete Carroll really likes. And if you go back to college, he was kind of a personal favorite of Pete Carroll. That was his guy in that draft. But you've just seen that he can't handle the full load. So I think that they really want to mix in those other guys. And I think if there could be a change over this final month, I think it could be maybe you see Rashad Penny start to kind of cut into Mike Davis's workload, because for the most part this season, it's been Carson to start the game. Then it's been Mike Davis getting 10 carries a game or something like that. And then basically whatever's left has gone to Rashad Penny, but he's, you know, sort of emerged a little bit, happened about, you know, 3 weeks ago in that Rams game when Carson couldn't play. He had the best game of his season so far. He had a long run against Green Bay and then didn't really do a whole lot last week just because they didn't really run the ball as much. They had to sort of switch gears because Carolina was taking away the run. So I think you could see Rashad Penny kind of start to take on a little bit bigger role, but it's going to be in that secondary role because I think Chris Carson's still going to be the guy as long as he's healthy.
All right, Brady, we talked about the offense for a bit here with the Seahawks. Let's get to the defense in a moment. But first, I want to talk about underwear. And it's not really specifically my underwear. It's about the underwear you should be wearing when you leave the house or when you're lounging around in your house yourself. You should be wearing MeUndies. It's something that I, in fact, wear every single time I leave the house, because I'm someone who likes to wear a nice pair of underwear, and it is, in fact, the most comfortable pair of underwear not only I've ever worn, but I feel extremely confident that you will ever wear. I recommend it outside of the podcast, to be clear. Before I ever had a MeUndies sponsorship, I was recommending it to my family, to my friends, to people, not really people I encountered on the street, that's sort of creepy, but I have to admit, I would tell anybody, without a podcast sponsorship, it is the most comfortable piece of underwear you will ever wear. It is made of sustainably sourced modal fabric. It's just different. It's just, when you put it on, it is different from any underwear you have ever worn before. And once you start wearing it, I feel quite confident in saying you are not going to be comfortable going back to what you wore previously. It is not only the underwear, it is the lounge pants. They are impeccable. They are the thing I wear when I am lounging around my apartment. They are extremely comfortable. They're, of course, different from the underwear, but they are phenomenal. And not something I got from MeUndies, something I purchased out of pocket because I was like, wow, this underwear is great. I believe the lounge pants will be incredible. And I was not wrong. I was, in fact, correct. And if you haven't tried MeUndies before, I have good news for you. You can try it with zero risk to you. Zero. You can incur no risk trying MeUndies. If you're a first-time purchaser, you will get 20% off your first pair of MeUndies and free shipping. Now, that's a little bit of risk because there's still 80% there. But here's the thing. If you don't like the underwear, whatever you buy at MeUndies, well, they're going to try and get you into a pair you like. And if you don't like it, if it does not work out for some reason, they're going to refund you. You can keep the underwear you purchased. I don't know why you would keep underwear if you didn't like it, but in this case, if you are someone who is very concerned about getting the specific underwear you don't like and want to keep, MeUndies is willing to accommodate you. But if you try it, I feel extremely confident in saying you are going to like it. So, to get your 20% off your first pair, free shipping, a 100% satisfaction guarantee, all of that, go to MeUndies.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Go to MeUndies.com/Barnwell. 20% off your first pair, free shipping, and the 100% satisfaction guarantee. MeUndies.com/Barnwell. In terms of the defensive side of the ball, Pete Carroll has a reputation going back to college of being a great secondary coach. And this was a unit on this team that really had a ton of turnover, given that, you know, Richard Sherman was cut. Cam Chancellor is probably retiring and certainly is not able to play. Earl Thomas has missed the vast majority of the season. Are you surprised with how well the secondary has held up over the course of the season?
Yeah, I think so. Because it's not only new guys, but, you know, at one cornerback spot, you've got a guy who's not only new, he's a rookie fifth-round pick who played safety in college. And, you know, the Seahawks went into this past draft with two guys that they felt like they absolutely had to have. Like, they were going to come away from this draft getting these two guys at all costs. And one was Will Disley, the tight end out of Washington that they took in the fourth round. And the other was Trey Flowers, the safety from Oklahoma State, who they got in the fifth round and then converted to right cornerback. And, you know, I think I looked at it and said, you know, there's a chance he's going to maybe play a little bit this season. But this could very well be a redshirt year for him just because, you know, he's learning a new position. That's a pretty tough transition. It would be for any rookie fifth-round pick who had played cornerback his entire college career. It would be hard enough for that guy, let alone a guy who's learning a new spot. So, you know, they got him ready in a hurry, and it kind of broke that way because Byron Maxwell was injured all summer. So was Dante Johnson. Those were the two veterans who they kind of signed to really, you know, fight for that starting spot. Ended up going to Trey Flowers, and he has held up better than I think anybody could reasonably expect for a guy in his position. You know, Pete Carroll said this recently, like there's those plays that he has where, you know, you get frustrated because it's a rookie mistake and stuff like that, and he'll get beat every now and again. But when the bigger picture, when you take all that into account, he's held up pretty well. And, you know, he's one thing that, you know, Pete Carroll really loves about any defensive player. This is sort of the essence of what Pete Carroll is as a defensive guy, is to get the ball. Mm-hmm. And you saw that a couple times in that Carolina game. The Panthers fumbled amazingly five times and recovered all five of them. But Trey Flowers got his hands on a few balls and knocked them out. And that's what Pete Carroll really likes to see. So, you know, his development and his growth, I think over this year, that's been one of those reasons why that secondary has been, it's probably held up better than a lot of people would have expected, just thinking, you know, seeing that you go from these all-pro, Pro Bowl, you know, maybe Hall of Fame-type names to a lot of no-names, and certainly that's not to take all the credit away from Bradley McDougal and Tender Thompson. Bradley McDougal has had a fantastic season. He's really kind of the glue that has held that group together. He had an interception himself Sunday against Carolina on a really good play. But probably the most surprising aspect of all of that was what's happening at the right side with Trey Flowers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought that, you know, there was a chance, maybe just because he had been such a good coach, and those guys who you mentioned, you know, were not superstars. Earl Thomas was a first-round pick, and he was supposed to be the guy, and he was, you know, he's a Hall of Fame caliber safety, but Richard Sherman was a mid-round pick, Cam Chancellor was a mid-round pick, Byron Maxwell was a late-round pick. I mean, it wasn't like they were playing with superstars coming out of school in those positions. So I was hopeful, but I don't think I saw this coming in terms of how well that secondary as a whole, including Flowers, have played over the course of this season. Now, brought up Earl Thomas, of course, a bunch of free agents coming after the year for Seattle. Earl Thomas, obviously, KJ Wright, Frank Clark, Shamar Stephen, J.R. Sweezy, DJ Fluker, Justin Coleman, Mike Davis. I mean, it seems like we can say pretty comfortably Earl Thomas is probably going to move on I mean, stop me if you disagree with me in that. It just seems like they are at the point where an exit might be best for both sides. But in terms of that core of players, do you think there is a player or two they're going to target to try and keep around? It seems like maybe Frank Clark would be the first person on that list.
Yeah, I think Clark has got to be the priority. And to your point on Thomas, you know, I think that you could say, like, in the sense that nothing should surprise anybody in the NFL ever, because there's always something crazy that happens. I would put the chances of re-signing Earl Thomas kind of in that same bucket, right? Like, it's almost certainly not going to happen, but you can't rule anything out. I think, you know, seeing him flip the bird on his way off the field in Arizona with the air cast over his leg, I think that was probably the last time that we saw Earl Thomas in a Seahawks uniform. But yeah, I think that Frank Clark has got to be the priority right now. And I spoke with his agent, who went on the record earlier this season about sort of their approach to that. And, you know, he said that, look, you know, and this is the agent speaking. He said, look, you know, we're not going to just settle for a deal right now just to have the security of a deal. And I think that, you know, he didn't say this name, but I think that he was probably looking at like a Danielle Hunter type of situation where, you know, Hunter took a deal for around $15 million a year before free agency. And now look at him. He's right among the league leaders in sacks. So, you know, the point from the agent was that they're not in any hurry to do a deal. Now, reading between the lines there, I think he was not in any hurry to do a deal because the offers hadn't really been there. You know, the type of offer that he hadn't wanted, you know, hadn't really been there. So the way I read that is I think that it's probably headed towards a franchise tag. Just because if the offer hasn't really been there, now maybe that offer comes later in the season, but if that offer is not really there, then I think that you know, Clark's side is probably going to want something around that franchise number. And the Seahawks, you know, without any sort of pass rushers, any proven pass rushers in the pipeline, you know, Frank Clark is just not a guy that they can afford to lose. So especially when, you know, you look at what they've lost there over the last few years, from Cliff Averill to Michael Bennett, Sheldon Richardson, you know, that pass rush, it's not a great pass rush as it is, and Frank Clark is your one sort of Pro Bowl caliber guy there. So I think that is probably headed towards the franchise tag. And then with KJ Wright, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see, because I always viewed this year as kind of a wait-and-see year for KJ Wright and the Seahawks. You know, he's approaching 30 years old. In the last year of his deal, they had just drafted Shaquem Griffin to see if, hey, maybe he can eventually replace KJ Wright at the weak side. Certainly we have not seen anything yet from Shaquem Griffin that suggests he's going to be ready to take that spot over next season. But KJ Wright's been banged up the entire year. He's going to miss his third straight game. I think it'll be nine games overall that he's missed because of that knee injury. And there's no really telling right now, you know, when he's going to come back. It's not going to be this weekend. And we'll see, you know, we'll see when and if he's going to be able to come back, because that knee has been, you know, pretty troublesome all year. So that's definitely, you know, a wild card heading into free agency for KJ Wright.
Speaking of free agency, is there a spot you think the Seahawks will target either in free agency or in the draft to sort of supplement their roster during the 2019 offseason?
Well, yeah, and I just mentioned it. They've got to upgrade that pass rush, and you know those guys, as you know, you're going to have a hard time trying to find those guys in free agency, because you know when teams get one, they usually don't let them get away. So I would say probably a pass rusher in the draft. You know, we'll see what they do on the offensive line. You know, J.R. Sweezy and D.J. Fluker, who I mentioned earlier, as being upgrades for them at guard. Those guys are both free agents. So I would think that they're going to want to bring those guys back, but you just never know with offensive linemen and you know, with the, if they can get that done. So yeah, certainly pass rusher and linebacker again. You know, just because of KJ Wright's situation, I don't think he's a guy that, if you look at all of the sort of those core players that they've already moved on from, I can't see them making it any sort of priority to re-sign KJ Wright at this point with his knee and the situation that it's in. So I think linebacker, pass rusher, and you know, they're set at running back right now, and they're pretty well set at wide receiver as well. So those are probably the two positions on defense that come to mind right away.
Yeah, and wide receiver is certainly not a deep class this offseason in terms of the guys who are going to be in the free agent market. So, Brady, let me finish up with this. Obviously, like we said, we talked about at the beginning of the show about the Seahawks team being surprising, being in a good position at 6-5, having those great odds of getting to the postseason. Maybe for Seahawks fans before the year, they might have had one set of expectations on what would make a successful season. That may have changed given how they've played, given the winning streak they've been able to put together. So let me ask you, Brady, in terms of where they are right now, given how they are positioned, given the four home games coming up over the final 5 weeks of the year, what would be, you think, to the majority of Seahawks fans, a successful season? Would 9-7 and missing the playoffs be successful? Would a playoff berth be successful? Or do they have to win a playoff game even to qualify as a successful season to the majority of the Seahawks fans who read your stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I really think it would depend on at what point you're asking that question. If you're asking it before the season, I think 9-7 and missing out on the playoffs, I think a lot of people would have taken that, just given all of the firepower that they either lost or moved on from. 9-7, you know, seemed like a lot of people would have been pretty good. At this point, though, it's almost like 9-7 would be, you know, I don't know if 9-7 is going to get you into the playoffs. And so 9-7 would almost feel like a disappointment right now, just because of the way that they've positioned themselves. And, you know, I'll say, if you're looking at it right now, what would make this season a success right now, I would probably say 10 wins. And that's very, very much attainable. You know, you've got three games against the two games against San Francisco, another one against Arizona. Those teams have, you know, two wins apiece. You've got the two primetime home games, Minnesota and Kansas City. Certainly, you know, in a normal setting, that Kansas City game against this Seattle defense, which again we've seen is flawed, that's a game that's going to go Kansas City's way almost every time. Mm-hmm. However, a couple things there. One, that's in Week 16. Kansas City, you never know. They if they have things wrapped up by that point, which is not out of the question, you wonder if they may have their foot off the gas a little bit. And it's also a primetime home game, and the Seahawks have been very good in primetime home games under Pete Carroll, 15-2. So you just never know. But I think winning four of the final five would make for a successful season right now. But again, even at 9-7, if you were to look back at that from the beginning of the season, I think a lot of people would take that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Brady, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Where can people check out more of the work you do covering the Seahawks?
Yep, it's all there on ESPN.com, and my Twitter handle, I always can never really remember it, but I think it's just at Brady Henderson. I think there's nothing special in there. I think it's just at Brady Henderson.
I believe I can confirm this, but I like that you can't remember it. It is, in fact, Brady Henderson. You've nailed it. That's probably the appropriate attitude to have towards your Twitter handle. I don't know.
Yeah. No underscores, no numbers, no nothing. Just Brady.
So if you want to impersonate Brady Henderson, the underscore market is available to you, but I'd recommend just following him on Twitter instead.
I'll check Brady out and see if Brady Anderson's available too. Maybe I can take that one.
You could professionally impersonate Brady Anderson here on Twitter. Well, Brady, it's always a pleasure have you back on, hopefully in the postseason, to talk about a Seahawks playoff run.
All right. Sounds good, Bill. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll be back with Jay Stewart of Football Perspective talking about the Jets and scoring in the NFL here on the Bill Barnwell Show in a moment. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show, and I'm joined by a frequent contributor to the show who we have not had on in quite a while. It is Football Perspective's Chase Stewart. Chase, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. Thanks for having me on. Frequent listener, and glad finally able to make my appearance this year.
Are you going to listen to your own appearance?
Yeah, for the first few minutes.
Then you'll get bored of yourself.
Then I'll get bored.
I can't listen to my own voice for very long, so I understand. But you have a very solid, very professional, very mature voice, and someone who has at least emotionally found a way to handle the struggles of your beloved New York Jets as a team that seems to be, how would I describe the New York Jets? A team that appears to be stuck in some sort of snow, I would say, on a week-to-week basis. How do you feel about the Jets, given your expectations heading into the season and what you've seen from them through 11 games?
You know, I think at a high level, you really could say they've been sort of where you thought they'd be. It's certainly more disappointing and depressing to watch it happen. But before the season, I think ESPN had the Jets either 31st or 32nd overall and either 31st or 32nd on offense. And that's, you know, pretty about right. I think Vegas had the Jets at around 5 or 6 wins. That's probably where they'll end up. and they've had, you know, inconsistent performances. Sometimes they've, you know, played pretty well. So I think if you look at what they've done, you wouldn't be too surprised. But yeah, it's a difficult. It's difficult to watch every week, and I think the most Jets fans were excited about Sam Darnold, and that's been probably a little bit disappointing, but it also, people expected him to play poorly, and he kind of has. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of in line with where we were thinking.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of Sam Darnold, and from my perspective, I find it really hard to judge exactly what he is or what sort of progress he's making or isn't making, just because I don't think the players around him are all that great. You know, we had that game in Week 1 where, you know, they blew out the Lions, and even after the pick six on the opening play, he was really impressive, and it was like, oh, you know, everyone kind of went on Twitter and said, oh, I knew he was going to be great from day one. You know, I had him number one on my board. Like, can't believe people thought Sam Darnold was blank when he's actually great. Like, you know, just this, that sort of like I knew all along, Twitter came in very quickly for Sam Darnold, and then he, you know, had some games where he struggled, and now he's not 100%, he's not on the field. Josh McCown has been playing quarterback with Sam Darnold injured. I mean, in terms of sort of not only as a fan, but your sort of analyst perspective on Sam Darnold, I mean, is there anything to take away that you think is meaningful or predicative from his rookie season, or is it just sort of he's struggling through the rookie blues with a team that is not necessarily all that great around him?
I think that's right. And remember, he's a young player. This is a 21-year-old quarterback who has a poor situation. I think there are a lot of Jets fans who are unhappy with the offensive coordinator and the head coach, sure, on top of the below-average skill position talent, on top of the below-average offensive line talent. And so thrusting a 21-year-old guy into that situation is not going to be a recipe for success. On the other hand, you've seen a lot of this. You know, Jets fans are used to a young quarterback who's struggling, and, you know, with Geno Smith, it was very easy to have a lot of the same concerns. The Jets supporting cast was not very good. You had the Stephen Hills and David Nelsons and Jeff Cumberlands of the world, and it was, well, how could Geno be any good with this? And so there's a point in time where you would hope a franchise quarterback would elevate the players around him. Sure. I don't think anybody expected a 21-year-old Sam Darnold to do that. So you give him a pass for the first year, maybe even part of the second year, but eventually, you know, you hope that the reason you want a franchise quarterback so badly is you are supposed to not need everything else.
I remember quite famously at the end of Sam Bradford's first season, you wrote a piece on your website, Football Perspective, about how Sam Bradford's first season was not very impressive, and you incurred the wrath of many a Rams fan at the time, and were in fact proven to be quite accurate and quite impressive in terms of your foresight of Sam Bradford. I mean, has your opinion of Sam Darnold changed whatsoever? Like, are you at the same position you were heading into the season on Sam Darnold?
No, you know, I think he's done a pretty good job in terms of being athletic, making some good decisions. He's been more aggressive than I think you would have expected, and I think it's a good thing. People can look at his interceptions. He does currently lead the league in interceptions. I'd almost view that as a positive, because a lot of those interceptions are late in the game when the Jets are trailing. He's trying to make something happen, and an interception really doesn't hurt the team's win probability. He's also aggressive, and I think that you'd rather, or I would rather, have a young quarterback who's wanting to take chances and make something happen versus a conservative player. So his interceptions aren't really a big concern, but he has not been laser accurate. He's not had a lot of, you know, successful downfield passes. Part of that is Robbie Anderson's not having a good year, and, you know, Jermaine Kearse is having a very bad year. So it's hard to separate him from that supporting cast. But I'd say from Darnold, he's looked pretty good. He's looked very good at times. Overall, he's probably a little bit below where you would have hoped, but it's certainly nothing that would dampen the optimism going forward for years 2, 3, and 4 if you had that before the season.
Yeah, I think so. And like I said, I just think it's so hard to judge. This was a weapons group that I ranked 32nd out of 32 teams before the year. And, you know, sitting here right now, maybe they're 28 or 29. Like, they're not that different from where I had them before the year. And of course, a bunch of free agents in that group as well. And I guess sort of the saving grace and the things that maybe Jets fans are looking forward to heading into this offseason is they're going to have, at the moment, they're projected to have $105 million in cap space. And, you know, certainly at the very least, no matter what the number comes in at, it's going to be a large number and a large amount of cap space. So from your perspective, not to, to make a pun on the name of your website, but from your angle, again, as an analyst and as a fan, I mean, do you see them going out and spending a ton of money to sort of surround Darnold with talent? And is that something that excites you, given the players who are likely to be available in the free agent market?
Yeah, so that's a great, you know, second part of your question is, I think the Jets absolutely want to. There's no question that whether there is a GM change or not, the ownership and whoever the GM is at the time is going to want to use this money, because that's what the money's for. The Jets have, they don't really have a lot of big contracts on offense, and so they need to bring in talent. Now, is that an option? Well, this is not a great free agent class, either at the offensive line or, you know, in the skill position, and particularly a receiver. It's not that, it's pretty poor. So I think Le'Veon Bell is probably a player that most fan bases are going to say he's going to get overpaid. They may think, I don't want my team to sign him. He's, you know, he's going to be an older running back. He's not going to be worth the money, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're the Jets, if you have $100 million, he is the only player at running back, receiver, or tight end who is a real difference maker. So it almost feels like you have to go after him, because how else are you going to improve the offense? And, yeah, you're going to overpay, but the receiving class is probably not going to be very good. But I think you have to try to get the best at all those players, you know, whether it's receiver, tight end, offensive line, and the Jets should be a pretty active group in free agency.
I mean, I think about this receiving class. I mentioned this a little bit earlier when we were talking to Brady Henderson. It's not great. It's certainly not a great receiving core. You're looking at guys like Devin Funchess, Tyrell Williams at the top of the draft class, or top of the receiver class, and you want to get Sam Darnold a weapon. Now, I think you know where I'm going to go, and I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I want to hear if you're going to surprise me. Would you rather go out and spend $12, $13, $14 million on Tyrell Williams or Devin Funchess to give Sam Darnold a legit weapon at wide receiver, or would you rather go out and spend $15 or $16 or $17 million a year on the one skill position guy who we think is going to be a game-changing talent in this free agent class, and that's Le'Veon Bell?
Yeah, I think the Jets could do both. You know, that they really do have.
Do you want them to do both?
$1 million, and well, you know, they've got this money, and there's also not going to be, you know, it's not like Darnold's contract is going to be up for a while, right? So they don't need to save the money. They're going to have the money next year too. I think the Jets need to be as aggressive as possible, because what else are they going to do, right? So they don't have, you know, they traded a second round pick for Darnold, you know, so they're down a second round pick this year. They may end up using their first round pick on a defensive player or an offensive lineman. So I think they have to do everything they can to maximize the you know, it sounds silly to say it, but maximize the Super Bowl window of Darnold on a rookie contract, which means bringing in as much talent as you can, in, you know, basically gearing up for 2020 and 2021 as those potential Super Bowl seasons.
Yeah, I mean, that is very optimistic.
I think I've stunned you by using the word Super Bowl and Jets in the same sentence. But if you're the GM, I think that's what you need to be thinking about. And to specifically answer your question, yeah, if it's an either or, I would rather go after Bell than, you know, save a few million dollars to get a worse player. But I think the Jets are going to be and should be active in free agency, because there's really not going to be another way to get better.
Would you rather not do it? I mean, would you rather sit there and say, let's shop in the middle tier, let's go out and get someone like a TJ Yeldon or a Tevin Coleman or at receiver, geez, I don't know, maybe even like a Golden Tate, where even if it's not going to be, it might be for a lot of money, but not on as long of a contract, maybe $12, $14 million on a one-year deal or a two-year deal, just to give Darnold some sort of weapons to build upon and then hope that in the years to come you'll find more players? Or is it just you have to take advantage of the window?
Well, I think they sort of have that C player, right? I mean, they've got Crowell, they've got Powell, they have Eli McGuire running back, you know, Curse, Anunua, Robbie Anderson. If they're not going to get a receiver who's notably better than those players, then it doesn't seem like it's really worth it. Now, I do personally like Golden Tate. He's obviously not been great in Philadelphia, so that might be an interesting option. But this is not a time for the Jets to be efficient with their cap dollars, because it's not like there are expenses coming up, right? It's almost a blank slate for this team.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about possibly changing general manager. It seems like Todd Bowles is probably, unless he goes on a maybe a win-out streak, going to lose his job as Jets head coach. Do you think Mike Maccagnan also deserves to keep his job and be the person who goes out and does spend that money that they freed up in cap space? Or do you think they should be bringing in someone who is, you know, a new voice or someone who has more scouting experience or someone who is just different from Maccagnan to, you know, take over this organization and sort of build around Darnold?
Yeah, I think they put it this way. I don't think Maccagnan has done anything or much to deserve keeping the job. I'm not sure he's been horrible and you have to fire him, but I don't think he's done much to say, oh, yeah, he deserves to be kept. He's the guy. I don't think any Jets fans are confident that he's the guy. The Hackenberg pick was a bad pick that still hasn't really been fully explained, and there's been a lot of poor drafts. Maccagnan's been here 4 years, and I just said that the Jets are a blank slate of a roster. So the fact that, you know, this is not a new GM, and he has not been able to build the team through the draft. He's had some, you know, there are some reasons and explanations, and so I think you could keep you can make an argument for keeping him, but I think the best argument the Jets would have is if you want to bring in a new coach, you want to have a coach and GM on the same page. I think bringing in them together makes sense. It could even be a situation where you bring in a very powerful figure who operates as coach and GM. And so from a different perspective, you could say the Jets are going to have $100 million of cap space and a 21-year-old player who could be a franchise quarterback. This is about as attractive as the Jets are going to ever look. So now is the time to try to go after the superstar coach GM because they may want to join you. So I think this is the opportunity to upgrade at coach and GM for the Jets.
Is there a dream coach or a dream GM who comes to mind for you where it would be you would be jumping for joy, texting your friends about how you wanted to get Jets tickets if he became the coach and general manager or just coach or just general manager?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I think on the realistic side,
yes,
because you know, they're not getting Sean McVay or Bill Belichick, but you know, I think if John Harbaugh leaves Baltimore, that would be a good addition. You know, he's a coach who's been very successful. He knows what he's doing in the NFL. I think he would add a certain level of legitimacy to the Jets. I don't know if there are enough names that make it that sort of the superstar factor that when Parcells came to the Jets in the late 90s, I don't think we've got that situation. But the Jets ownership should view this as the opportunity to sort of hit restart on the franchise. And it's almost like, you know, if you're doing a Madden simulator, it's, hey, take over a team with $100 million and a franchise quarterback. That's great. Let's go. Let's get. That's where you start. So this is a good opportunity, I think, for a clean break.
All right, Chase. Well, for your sake, stop talking about the Jets for a moment. Let's talk about our pals at Dollar Shave Club. Now, I've brought up Dollar Shave Club before, and there are so many reasons why I enjoy being someone who works with Dollar Shave Club. It's not just that the products are great, and they are. They smell great. I look great. I feel great. Maybe look great is a little much for me. It might make you look great. There's only so much Dollar Shave Club can do for anybody, myself included specifically, but I look the best I can possibly look because I'm working with Dollar Shave Club. The best part about it, I don't have to go to the store. Everything I'm getting to make myself look great, feel great, smell great, you get the idea. I don't have to go to a store to get that. Dollar Shave Club is shipping it to my door. Can't beat that. I live in New York. It's quite cold. It's very windy. I do not want to go outside and have to go to the store to go pick up a product so I can shave. I don't have to do that. I can go to dollarshaveclub.com, order it, and they ship it right to me. And they'll keep shipping it to me as frequently or as infrequently as I need it. So the toothpaste, for example, I love it. I just tried it a few weeks ago for the first time. Brushed my teeth. My teeth smell good. Seems like something that might be a little too specific, but my mouth smells good. I don't get that feeling of, oof, I need to brush my teeth again. It lasts. It is a great smell. And when I'm running out, Dollar Shave Club sends me more. I don't know how they figure out how much time I need, but it is perfect. When I need it, it shows up with Dollar Shave Club. I'm never running out of toothpaste. So if you encounter me on the street in New York, you don't have to worry that my mouth, my breath are going to smell gross. Thanks, Dollar Shave Club. And with their handsome discount, I don't know what that's about, but maybe you're a handsome person, you want a handsome discount. The more you buy, the more you save. And right now, they've got a bunch of starter sets you can try for just $5, like their oral care kit, which includes that toothpaste I just mentioned. After that, the restock box ships regularly sized products at regular price. So what are you waiting for? Get that starter set right now for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. That's dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. Now back to the show. I think it's a really exciting opportunity for the right coach, and I think it could turn around pretty quickly if they do get the right guy. I wanted to talk to you about something else, though, because, of course, I'm a regular reader of your website at Football Perspective. Quite often, I will think, oh, I should write about that. And then I realize that you have either already written about it, or in the time between me thinking of it and writing it, you go ahead and write it and do a better job than I would have done, which is quite frustrating.
I don't do a better job, but I'm quicker.
You are certainly someone who writes quite frequently for someone who, again, has a full-time job in addition to writing for Football Perspective, your website, but you wrote a really great piece, and I think a really important piece in terms of understanding how the game is being played in 2018. And this was specifically about sort of how the change in scoring and the change in how frequently teams are scoring and how frequently teams are scoring touchdowns as opposed to field goals and as opposed to getting stopped altogether should change the math coaches use in evaluating their decisions with regards to going for it or kicking field goals or punting. And can you explain sort of how the modern game and how 2018 and how the scoring rate has changed and how that impacts how coaches should make their decisions?
Yeah, and so I think the best way to think about it is think about an extreme case. I mean, we're almost there, but think about an NFL where offenses were just so incredible, and there were rules changes to make offenses really, really efficient, and they basically score a field goal or a touchdown on every drive. In that scenario, a field goal is basically worthless because
right.
you can get a field goal on every drive. And so if you are if you're fourth and goal at the 2-yard line, a field goal really doesn't mean much because the other team's going to come down and get a field goal on the next drive or a touchdown. So it's not, in the 1970s, a field goal might be much more valuable in a game where teams aren't scoring that much. And so that's the extreme example. But we're actually seeing, an NFL in 2018 that's bordering on that because after you score a field goal or a touchdown, you obviously kick off. On average this season, after a kickoff and teams get the ball at around the 25, 26-yard line, teams are scoring 2 points per drive. And so that includes 7 points for touchdown, 3 points for field goal. Obviously, there are some failed drives, but that's 2 points per drive. And 15 years ago, that was about 1.5 points per drive. You also have turnover rates going down significantly. So offenses are so much better than they used to be that the value of 3 points isn't very much because the other team is probably not going to turn the ball over, and they've got a very good chance of scoring and maybe scoring seven. And what that means is the delta between 3 points and 7 points is actually pretty significant, I think, more than it used to be, because if you, some quick math, and this isn't the exact way to think about it, but if you think I'm going to get a field goal, the other team's going to score 2 points on the next drive because that's on average. Well, now I'm plus one. If I get a touchdown and they're going to get 2 points on the next drive, that's plus five. Five is a lot better than one. So I think that's the thinking coaches need to be doing. It's not 7 versus 3. It's 5 versus 1.
Yeah, and I mean, in the past, it would have been, if it had been the more traditional scoring rates?
Yeah, so it was, about 1.5 per drive. So it's more thinking about, I think what happens with coaches and analysts, I think 7-3, it's about twice as much. But if you start thinking about it as, 5-1 or 5.5-1.5, it kind of, you realize how big of the magnitude is. And you see this. This is not... this is obviously a very academic discussion we're having, but we see it all the time. Teams score touchdowns with a minute left in the half or the end of the game, and then the other team gets the kickoff and drives down for a field goal. The reality is it is not hard for teams to drive down and kick a field goal. Gaining yards has never been easier. Moving down the field has never been easier. And field goal kickers have never been better. And so that means a field goal just isn't that worthwhile. And so if I was the head coach or if I was somebody in charge of NFL, decision-making, I would think if you're on the fence as to whether kick a field goal or go for a touchdown, the math is probably going to be overwhelming in favor of going for the touchdown. Your gut probably is the thing that's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes sense given that, if you're a coach, unless you're Sean McVay, you're in your 40s and your 50s, maybe even your 60s if you're someone like Pete Carroll. And the game you not only grew up watching, but the game you grew up coaching at lower levels where you sort of formed your beliefs in the game you grew up playing, if you were a player, that's changed. It's so much different than it was in the 1970s or the 1980s or even the 1990s. I mean, it really has been a staggering leap and a staggering shift in terms of scoring. And over the last decade, with 2017 maybe as a sort of hiccup, it's really also increased dramatically. Outside of those fourth down decisions, is there a way that coaches might change the way they view the game, and a way they might change the way they make their decisions based upon this sort of logic?
Well, I think it's what the overall, you know, arching theme here is possession is really valuable. Having the ball is valuable, and it's valuable because the team with the ball has a really good chance of scoring. And 30 years ago, the team with the ball had a decent chance of scoring. And so that's sort of what people need to be thinking about. And it could be involved in a lot of, you know, there are other implications besides fourth downs. It could be, you know, onside kicks, especially after a, you know, 15-yard penalty after touchdown. You see teams kick off at the 50, could be a good time to do an onside kick because possession is so valuable. Possession matters more than field position. And so if you're thinking about how to keep the ball out of the other team's hands, whether it's by being more aggressive on fourth downs and also playing the clock. I think teams are not well conditioned to thinking about how to drain the clock. And you know, I was watching the Eagles game and just thinking about this on Sunday against the Giants, and I thought they made a great decision to go for it at the end of the game. Or it wasn't the end. There was, you know, 2.5 minutes left on fourth and one. And I'm thinking, if they get this, they can probably milk the clock. And that's all they need is to get this one possession. And that's exactly what happened. They converted fourth and one against the Giants. And by the time the Giants got the ball back, there was 25 seconds left. And that was more valuable than anything else. Because being able to control how the game's going down, because it's easier to gain yards, you can be aggressive on fourth down, keep possession, and the team that's keeping possession is probably going to be the smart team.
Yeah. I mean, I think about the Chiefs-Rams game, where it was almost like I tweeted it as a joke about, you know, the Chiefs scored too early when they scored their final touchdown of the game. And they ended up getting, like, several possessions afterwards because the Rams also scored very quickly. But I think when it's easier to score, and it's easier to score when you have a great offense like the Chiefs, I think you're not going to sit there and not try to score, obviously. But I think you have to be conscious about burning clock and making sure your guys are staying in bounds when you're in that situation. It's a close game and you have a great offense and you're playing great offense. I think you have to be more cognizant of managing the clock and manipulating the clock to your needs than ever before, because, you know, before, I think when you're a trailing team, everyone knows, okay, you got to get a bounce, you got to, you know, throw to the sidelines, you got to manage the clock effectively. But now I think it's also really meaningful when you're trying to burn clock as well, whether you have the lead or whether you're even trailing by a tiny bit.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's a great point, because the ability to manipulate the clock is, I think, what you'll see teams mess up a lot as offenses get better. And it's already happening. The Chiefs-Rams game is a good example. I 100% agree, right? Being able to figure out when to score, because it's easier to move the ball, you can almost figure out when to score. You know, the goal is not to score the most points. The goal is to maximize your chances of winning. But I'll even go a step further on that and say that teams can also start thinking about sort of going 2-for-1. If there's 4 minutes left and you're at the 30-yard, you know, the opponent's 30-yard line, you may want to score quickly so you have time to get the ball back after they score. You know, if you're with 4 minutes left and you score with 2 minutes left, if it takes you 2 minutes to get those extra 30 yards, that's a much worse scenario. And so I think coaches need to be thinking basically like a chess game, a few levels ahead as to what moves do I need to make, because I need to make sure I'm maximizing the clock, because I know this is not the game I grew up watching. Teams are going to move the ball down the field very quickly.
Well, I'll tell you what, Chase, as a Jets fan, me growing up as a Giants fan, we have two great offenses right now. We don't need to worry about manipulating the clock because we're just going to score at will. But for those lesser teams like the Rams and the Chiefs, they might have to be more concerned about managing the clock because they might not be able to manipulate games the way that Todd Bowles and Pat Shurmur do.
I'm always talking to my brother about this, and he is a huge Jets fan, and he keeps saying, I don't really believe you when you tell me it's so easy to move the ball down the field. And, you know, he may be right.
It's funny how that works. Well, Chase, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I wish it was under more exciting more exciting scenarios for the Jets, but always a pleasure to have you on. Someone I read every time you write something, and follow him on Twitter as well. But Chase, where can people check out more of the work you do covering the NFL?
Yeah, thanks so much again for having me on, Bill. I love reading and listening to your stuff. You can go to the website, footballperspective.com, and I'm on Twitter at FBGChase, and I'll be writing about math and the Jets in probably that order for a while. So thanks for having me on again.
Always a pleasure, sir. We are finished up here on the Bill Barnwell Show. Thanks so much for listening today. More audio coming on Monday. Recap of Week 13. Thanks so much for listening.